We need some sleep. Wonderful, I thought. Now Meg is finishing my sentences. This time I could not argue with her logic. Despite my fervor to rush into the woods and save my children, I had to proceed cautiously. I could not mess up this rescue. And I was increasingly certain that the beast would keep his captives alive for now. He needed them to lure me into his trap. Chiron rose on his front hooves.
This evening, then. Rest and prepare, my heroes. I fear you will need all your strength and wits for what comes next.
Chapter 22. Armed to the Eyeballs. A Combat Ukulele. Magic Brazil Scarf. Sun gods are not good at sleeping during the day, but somehow I managed a fitful nap. When I woke in the late afternoon, I found the camp in a state of agitation. Kayla and Dawson's disappearance had been the tipping point. The other campers were now so rattled no one could maintain a normal schedule. I suppose a single demigod disappearing every few weeks felt like a normal casualty rate. But a pair of demigods disappearing in the middle of a camp-sanctioned activity? That meant no one was safe. Word must have spread of our conference in the cave. The Victor twins had stuffed wads of cotton in their ears to foil the oracular voices. Julia and Alice had climbed to the top of the lava wall and were using binoculars to scan the woods, no doubt hoping to spot the grove of Dodona. But I doubted they could see the trees for the forest. Everywhere I went, people were unhappy to see me. Damien and Kiara sat together at the canoe dock, glowering in my direction. Sherman Yang waved me away when I tried to talk with him. He was busy decorating the Ares cabin with frag grenades and brightly decorated claymores. If it had been Saturnalia, he definitely would have won the prize for most violent holiday decorations. Even the Athena Parthenos stared down at me accusingly from the top of the hill, as if to say, "This is all your fault." She was right. If I hadn't let Python take over Delphi, if I'd paid more attention to the other ancient oracles, if I hadn't lost my divinity. "Stop it, Apollo," I scolded myself. "You're beautiful, and everyone loves you." But it was becoming increasingly difficult to believe that. My father, Zeus, did not love me. The demigods at Camp Half-Blood did not love me. Python and the Beast and his comrades at Triumvirate Holdings did not love me. It was almost enough to make me question my self-worth. No, no. That was crazy talk. Chiron and Rachel were nowhere to be seen. Nissa Barrera informed me that they were hoping against hope to use the camp's sole internet connection in Chiron's office to access more information about Triumvirate Holdings. Harley was with them for tech support. They were presently on hold with Comcast customer service and might not emerge for hours, if indeed they survived the ordeal at all. I found Meg at the armory, browsing for battle supplies. She had strapped a leather cuirass over her green dress, and greaves over orange leggings, so she looked like a kindergartner reluctantly stuffed into combat gear by her parents. "Perhaps a shield?" I suggested. "Nuh-uh." She showed me her rings. "I always use two swords. Plus, I need a free hand for slapping when you act stupid." I had the uncomfortable sense she was serious. From the weapon rack, she pulled out a longbow and offered it to me. I recoiled. "No." "It's your best weapon. You're Apollo." I swallowed back the tang of mortal bile. I swore an oath. I'm not the god of archery or music anymore. I won't use a bow or a musical instrument until I can use them properly. Stupid oath. She didn't slap me, but she looked like she wanted to. "What will you do? Just stand around and cheer while I fight?" That had indeed been my plan, but now I felt silly admitting it. I scanned the weapon display and grabbed a sword. Even without drawing it, I could tell it would be too heavy and awkward for me to use. But I strapped the scabbard around my waist.
There,
I said.
Happy?
Meg did not appear happy. Nevertheless, she returned the bow to its place.
Fine, she said. But you'd better have my back.
I had never understood that expression. It made me think of the kick-me signs Artemis used to tape to my toga during festival days. Still, I nodded.
Your back shall be had.
We reached the edge of the woods and found a small going-away party waiting for us. Will and Nico, Paolo Montez, Malcolm Pace, and Billy Ng, all with grim faces.
Be careful, Will told me. And here.
Before I could object, he placed a ukulele in my hands. I tried to give it back.
I can't. I made an oath.
Yeah, I know. That was stupid of you. But it's a combat ukulele. You can fight with it if you need to. I looked more closely at the instrument. It was made from celestial bronze, thin sheets of metal acid-etched to resemble the grain of blonde oak wood. The instrument weighed next to nothing, yet I imagined it was almost indestructible.
The work of Hephaestus?
I asked.
Will shook his head.
The work of Harley. He wanted you to have it. Just sling it over your back. For me and Harley. It'll make us both feel better.
I decided I was obliged to honor the request, though my possession of a ukulele had rarely made anyone feel better. Don't ask me why. When I was a god, I used to do an absolutely blistering ukulele version of Satisfaction.
Nico handed me some ambrosia wrapped in a napkin.
I can't eat this, I reminded him.
It's not for you.
He glanced at Meg, his eyes full of misgiving. I remembered that the son of Hades had his own ways of sensing the future, futures that involved the possibility of death. I shivered and tucked the ambrosia into my coat pocket. As aggravating as Meg could be, I was deeply unsettled by the idea that she might come to harm. I decided that I could not allow that to happen. Malcolm was showing Meg a parchment map, pointing out various places in the woods that we should avoid. Paolo, looking completely healed from his leg surgery, stood next to him, carefully and earnestly providing Portuguese commentary that no one could understand. When they were finished with the map, Billy Ng approached Meg. Billy was a wisp of a girl. She compensated for her diminutive stature with the fashion sense of a K-pop idol. Her winter coat was the color of aluminum foil. Her bobbed hair was aquamarine and her makeup gold. I completely approved. In fact, I thought I could rock that look myself if I could just get my acne under control. Billy gave Meg a flashlight and a small packet of flower seeds.
Just in case, Billy said.
Meg seemed quite overwhelmed. She gave Billy a fierce hug. I didn't understand the purpose of the seeds, but it was comforting to know that in a dire emergency, I could hit people with my ukulele while Meg planted geraniums. Malcolm Pace gave me his parchment map.
When in doubt, veer to the right. That usually works in the woods, though I don't know why.
Paolo offered me a green and gold scarf, a bandana version of the Brazilian flag. He said something that, of course, I could not understand.
Nico smirked.
That's Paolo's good luck bandana. I think he wants you to wear it. He believes it will make you invincible.
I found this dubious, since Paolo was prone to serious injury. But as a god, I had learned never to turn down offerings.
Thank you.
Paolo gripped my shoulders and kissed my cheeks. I may have blushed. He was quite handsome when he wasn't bleeding out from dismemberment. I rested my hand on Will's shoulder.
Don't worry. We'll be back by dawn.
His mouth trembled ever so slightly.
How can you be sure?
I'm the sun god, I said,
trying to muster more confidence than I felt. I always return at dawn. Of course, it rained. Why would it not? Up on Mount Olympus, Zeus must have been having a good laugh at my expense. Camp Half-Blood was supposed to be protected from severe weather, but no doubt my father had told Aeolus to pull out all the stops on his winds. My jilted ex-girlfriends among the air nymphs were probably enjoying their moment of payback. The rain was just on the edge of sleet, liquid enough to soak my clothes, icy enough to slam against my exposed face like glass shards. We stumbled along, lurching from tree to tree to find any shelter we could. Patches of old snow crunched under my feet. My ukulele got heavier as its sound hole filled with rain. Meg's flashlight beam cut across the storm like a cone of yellow static. I led the way, not because I had any destination in mind, but because I was angry. I was tired of being cold and soaked. I was tired of being picked on. Mortals often talk about the whole world being against them. That is ridiculous. Mortals aren't that important. In my case, the whole world really was against me. I refused to surrender to such abuse. I would do something about it. I just wasn't quite sure what. From time to time, we heard monsters in the distance. The roar of a Drakon. The harmonized howl of a two-headed wolf. But nothing showed itself. On a night like this, any self-respecting monster would have remained in its lair, warm and cozy. After what seemed like hours, Meg stifled a scream. I heroically leaped to her side, my hand on my sword. I would have drawn it, but it was really heavy and got stuck in the scabbard. At Meg's feet, wedged in the mud, was a glistening black shell the size of a boulder. It was cracked down the middle, the edges splattered with a foul, gooey substance. I almost stepped on that. Meg covered her mouth as if she might be sick. I inched closer. The shell was the crushed carapace of a giant insect. Nearby, camouflaged among the tree roots, lay one of the beast's dismembered legs. It's a Myrmica, I said. Or it was. Behind her rain-splattered glasses, Meg's eyes were impossible to read. A Myrmerky? A giant ant. There must be a colony somewhere in the woods. Meg gagged. I hate bugs. That made sense for a daughter of the agriculture goddess. But to me, the dead ant didn't seem any grosser than the piles of garbage in which we often swam. Well, don't worry, I said. This one is dead. Whatever killed it must have had powerful jaws to crack that shell. Not comforting. Are these things dangerous? I laughed. Oh, yes. They range in size from as small as dogs to larger than grizzly bears. One time I watched a colony of Myrmicas attack a Greek army in India. It was hilarious. They spit acid that can melt through bronze armor and... Apollo... My smile faded. I reminded myself I was no longer a spectator. These ants could kill us. Easily. And Meg was scared. Right, I said. Well, the rain should keep the Myrmicas in their tunnels. Just don't make yourself an attractive target. They like bright, shiny things. Like flashlights? Meg handed me the flashlight. Lead on, Apollo. I thought that was unfair, but we forged ahead. After another hour or so, surely the woods weren't this big. The rain tapered off, leaving the ground steaming. The air got warmer. The humidity approached bathhouse levels. Thick white vapor curled off the tree branches. What's going on? Meg wiped her face. Feels like a tropical rainforest now. I had no answer. Then up ahead, I heard a massive flushing sound, like water being forced through pipes or fissures. I couldn't help but smile. A geyser, A geyser? Meg repeated. Like Old Faithful?
This is excellent news. Perhaps we can get directions. Our lost demigods might have even found sanctuary there.
With the geysers, Meg said.
No, my ridiculous girl, I said. With the geyser gods. Assuming they're in a good mood, this could be great.
And if they're in a bad mood?
Then we'll cheer them up before they can boil us. Follow me.
Chapter 23. Scale of 1 to 10. How would you rate your demise?
Thanks for your input. Was I reckless to rush toward such volatile nature gods?
Please.
Second-guessing myself is not in my nature. It's a trait I've never needed.
True, my memories about the Palikoi were a little hazy.
As I recalled, the geyser gods in ancient Sicily used to give refuge to runaway slaves, so they must be kindly spirits. Perhaps they would also give refuge to lost demigods, or at least notice when five of them wandered through their territory, muttering incoherently. Besides, I was Apollo. The Palikoi would be honored to meet a major Olympian such as myself. The fact that geysers often blew their tops, spewing columns of scalding hot water hundreds of feet in the air, wasn't going to stop me from making some new fans. I mean, friends. The clearing opened before us like an oven door. A wall of heat billowed through the trees and washed over my face. I could feel my pores opening to drink in the moisture, which would hopefully help my spotty complexion. The scene before us had no business being in a Long Island winter. Glistening vines wreathed the tree branches. Tropical flowers bloomed from the forest floor. A red parrot sat on a banana tree, heavy with green bunches. In the midst of the glade stood two geysers, twin holes in the ground, ringed with the figure eight of gray mud pots. The craters bubbled and hissed, but they were not spewing at the moment. I decided to take that as a good omen. Meg's boots squished in the mud. Is it safe?
Definitely not, I said. We'll need an offering. Perhaps your packet of seeds?
Meg punched my arm. Those are magic! For life and death emergencies. What about your ukulele? You're not going to play it anyway.
A man of honor never surrenders his ukulele. I perked up.
But wait. You've given me an idea. I will offer the geyser gods a poem.
I can still do that. It doesn't count as music.
Meg frowned. I don't know if...
Don't be envious, Meg. I will make up a poem for you later. This will surely please the geyser gods.
I walked forward, spread my arms, and began to improvise.
Oh, geyser, my geyser, let us spew then, you and I, upon this midnight dreary while we ponder. Whose woods are these? For we have not gone gentle into this good night, but have wandered lonely as clouds. We seek to know for whom the bell tolls, so I hope, spring's eternal, that the time has come to talk of many things.
I don't wish to brag, but I thought it was rather good. Even if I did recycle a few bits from my earlier works. Unlike my music and archery, my godly skills with poetry seemed to be completely intact. I glanced at Meg, hoping to see shining admiration on her face. It was high time the girl started to appreciate me. Instead, her mouth hung open, aghast.
What?
I demanded. Did you fail poetry appreciation in school? That was first-rate stuff.
Meg pointed toward the geysers. I realized she was not looking at me at all.
Well, said a raspy voice, you got my attention.
One of the Palikoi hovered over his geyser. His lower half was nothing but steam. From the waist up, he was perhaps twice the size of a human, with muscular arms the color of caldera mud. Chalk-white eyes and hair like cappuccino foam. as if he had shampooed vigorously and left it sudsy. His massive chest was stuffed into a baby blue polo shirt with a logo of trees embroidered on the chest pocket.
"Oh, great Palakos," I said. "We beseech you."
"What was that?"
the spirit interrupted.
"That stuff you were saying."
"Poetry," I said.
"For you."
He tapped his mud-gray chin.
"No, that wasn't poetry."
I couldn't believe it. Did no one appreciate the beauty of language anymore?
"My good spirit," I said. "Poetry doesn't have to rhyme, you know."
"I'm not talking about rhyming. I'm talking about getting your message across. We do a lot of market research, and that would not fly for our campaign. Now, the Oscar Mayer Wiener song, that is poetry. The ad is 50 years old, and people are still singing it. Do you think you could give us some poetry like that?"
I glanced at Meg to be sure I was not imagining this conversation.
"Listen here," I told the geyser god. "I've been the lord of poetry for 4,000 years. I ought to know good poetry."
The Palakos waved his hands.
"Let's start over. I'll run through our spiel, and maybe you can advise me. Hi, I'm Pete. Welcome to the woods at Camp Half-Blood. Would you be willing to take a short customer satisfaction survey after this encounter? Your feedback is important."
Great. Thanks."
Pete fished around in his vaporous region where his pockets would be. He produced a glossy brochure and began to read.
"The woods are your one-stop destination for..." It says fun. "I thought we changed that to exhilaration. See, you've got to choose your words with care. If Polly were here..." Pete sighed. "Well, he's better with the showmanship. Anyway, welcome to the woods at Camp Half-Blood."
"You already said that," I noted.
"Oh, right."
Pete produced a red pen and began to edit.
"Hey,"
Meg shouldered past me. She had been speechless with awe for about 12 seconds, which must have been a new record.
"Mr. Steamy Mud, have you seen any lost demigods?"
"Mr. Steamy Mud," Pete slapped his brochure. "That is effective branding. And great point about lost demigods. We can't have our guests wandering around aimlessly. We should be handing out maps at the entrance to the woods. So many wonderful things to see in here, and no one even knows about them. I'll talk to Polly when he gets back."
Meg took off her fogged-up glasses.
"Who's Polly?"
Pete gestured at the second geyser.
"My partner. Maybe we could add a map to this brochure if..."
"So, have you seen any lost demigods?" I asked.
"What?"
Pete tried to mark his brochure, but the steam had made it so soggy his red pen went right through the paper.
"Oh, no, not recently. But we should have better signage. For instance, did you even know these geysers were here?"
"No," I admitted.
"Well, there you go. Double geysers. The only ones on Long Island. And no one even knows about us. No outreach. No word of mouth. This is why we convinced the board of directors to hire us."
Meg and I looked at each other. I could tell that for once we were on the same wavelength. Utter confusion.
"Sorry," I said. "Are you telling me the forest has a board of directors?"
"Well, of course," Pete said. "The dryads, the other nature spirits, the sentient monsters. I mean, somebody has to think about property values and services and public relations. It wasn't easy getting the board to hire us for marketing either. If we mess up this job... Oh, man."
Meg squished her shoes in the mud.
"Can we go? I don't understand what this guy's talking about."
"And that's the problem," Pete moaned. "How do we write clear ad copy that conveys the right image of the woods? For instance, Palakoi, like Polly and me, used to be famous. Major tourist destinations. People would come to us to make binding oaths. Runaway slaves would seek us out for shelter. We'd get sacrifices, offerings, prayers. It was great. Now, nothing.
I heaved a sigh. I know how you feel.
Guys, Meg said, we're looking for missing demigods.
Right, I agreed.
Oh, great, Pete.
Do you have any idea where our lost friends might have gone? Perhaps you know of some secret locations within the woods?
Pete's chalk-white eyes brightened.
Did you know the children of Hephaestus have a hidden workshop to the north called Bunker 9?
I did, actually, I said.
Oh.
A puff of steam escaped Pete's left nostril.
Well, did you know the labyrinth has rebuilt itself? There is an entrance right here in the woods.
We know,
Meg said.
Pete looked crestfallen.
But perhaps, I said,
that's because your marketing campaign is working.
Do you think so?
Pete's foamy hair began to swirl.
Yes, yes, that may be true. Did you happen to see our spotlights, too? Those were my idea.
Spotlights? Meg asked.
Twin beams of red light blasted from the geysers and swept across the sky. Lit from beneath, Pete looked like the world's scariest teller of ghost stories.
Unfortunately, they attracted the wrong kind of attention. Pete sighed. Polly doesn't let me use them often. He suggested advertising on a blimp instead. Or perhaps a giant inflatable King Kong.
That's cool, Meg interrupted. But can you tell us anything about a secret grove with whispering trees?
I had to admit, Meg was good at getting us back on topic. As a poet, I did not cultivate directness. But as an archer, I could appreciate the value of a straight shot.
Oh.
Pete floated lower in his cloud of steam, the spotlight turning him the color of cherry soda.
I'm not supposed to talk about the grove.
My once godly ears tingled. I resisted the urge to scream.
Aha!
Why can't you talk about the grove, Pete?
The spirit fiddled with his soggy brochure.
Polly said it would scare away tourists. Talk about the dragons, he told me. Talk about the wolves and serpents and ancient killing machines. But don't mention the grove.
Ancient killing machines? Meg asked.
Yeah, Pete said half-heartedly. We're marketing them as fun family entertainment. But the grove. Polly said that was our worst problem. The neighborhood isn't even zoned for an oracle. Polly went there to see if maybe we could relocate it, but...
He didn't come back, I guessed.
Pete nodded miserably.
How am I supposed to run the marketing campaign all by myself? Sure, I can use robocalls for the phone surveys, but a lot of networking has to be done face-to-face, and Polly was always better with that stuff.
Pete's voice broke into a sad hiss.
I miss him.
Maybe we could find him, Meg suggested, and bring him back.
Pete shook his head.
Polly made me promise not to follow him, and not to tell anybody else where the grove is. He's pretty good at resisting those weird voices, but you guys wouldn't stand a chance.
I was tempted to agree. Finding ancient killing machines sounded much more reasonable. Then I pictured Kayla and Austin wandering through the ancient grove, slowly going mad. They needed me, which meant I needed their location.
Sorry, Pete. I gave him my most critical stare, the one I used to crush aspiring singers during Broadway auditions. I'm just not buying it.
Mud bubbled around Pete's caldera.
What do you mean?
I don't think this grove exists, I said. And if it does, I don't think you know its location.
Pete's geyser rumbled.
Steam swirled in his spotlight beam.
I do know. Of course it exists.
Oh, really? Then why aren't there billboards about it all over the place? And a dedicated website? Why haven't I seen a Grove of Dodona hashtag on social media? Pete glowered.
I suggested all of that. Polly shot me down.
So do some outreach, I demanded. Sell us on your product. Show us where this grove is.
I can't. The only entrance.
He glanced over my shoulder and his face went slack.
Ah, spew.
His spotlight shut off. I turned. Meg made a squelching sound even louder than her shoes in the mud. It took a moment for my vision to adjust, but at the edge of the clearing stood three black ants the size of Sherman tanks. Pete, I said, trying to remain calm. When you said your spotlights attracted the wrong kind of attention...
I meant the Myrmecas, he said. I hope this won't affect your online review of the woods at Camp Half-Blood.
Chapter 24. Breaking my promise. Spectacularly failing. I blame Neil Diamond. Myrmecas should be high on your list of monsters not to fight. They attack in groups, they spit acid, their pincers can snap through celestial bronze. Also, they are ugly. The three soldier ants advanced, their 10-foot-long antennae waving and bobbing in a mesmerizing way, trying to distract me from the true danger of their mandibles. Their beaked heads reminded me of chickens. Chickens with dark, flat eyes and black armored faces. Each of their six legs would have made a fine construction winch. Their oversized abdomens throbbed and pulsed like noses sniffing for food. I silently cursed Zeus for inventing ants. The way I heard it, he got upset with some greedy man who was always stealing from his neighbor's crops. So Zeus turned him into the first ant. A species that does nothing but scavenge, steal, and breed. Ares liked to joke that if Zeus wanted such a species, he could have just left humans the way they were. I used to laugh. Now that I am one of you, I no longer find it funny. The ant stepped toward us, their antennae twitching. I imagine their train of thought was something like, shiny? Tasty? Defenseless? No sudden movements, I told Meg, who did not seem inclined to move at all. In fact, she looked petrified. Oh, Pete, I called. How do you deal with Myrmecas invading your territory?
By hiding, he said,
and disappeared into the geyser. Not helpful, I grumbled. Can we dive in? Meg asked. Only if you fancy boiling to death in a pit of scalding water. The tank bugs clacked their mandibles and edged closer. I have an idea. I unslung my ukulele. I thought you swore not to play, Meg said. I did. But if I throw this shiny object to one side, the ants might... I was about to say, the ants might follow it and leave us alone. I neglected to consider that, in my hands, the ukulele made me look shinier and tastier. Before I could throw the instrument, the soldier ants surged toward us. I stumbled back, only remembering the geyser behind me when my shoulder blades began to blister, filling the air with Apollo-scented steam. Hey, bugs! Meg's scimitars flashed in her hands, making her the new shiniest thing in the clearing. Can we take a moment to appreciate that Meg did this on purpose? Terrified of insects, she could have fled and left me to be devoured. Instead, she chose to risk her life by distracting three tank-size ants. Throwing garbage at street thugs was one thing. But this was an entirely new level of foolishness. If I lived, I might have to nominate Meg McCaffrey for Best Sacrifice at the next Demi Awards. Two of the ants charged at Meg. The third stayed on me, though he turned his head long enough for me to sprint to one side. Meg ran between her opponents, her golden blades severing a leg from each. Their mandibles snapped at empty air. The soldier bugs wobbled on their five remaining legs, tried to turn, and bonked heads. Meanwhile, the third ant charged me. In a panic, I threw my combat ukulele. It bounced off the ant's forehead with a dissonant twang. I tugged my sword free of its scabbard. I've always hated swords. Such inelegant weapons. And they require you to be in close combat. How unwise, when you can shoot your enemies with an arrow from across the world. The ant spit acid, and I tried to swat away the goop. Perhaps that wasn't the brightest idea. I often got sword fighting and tennis confused. At least some of the acid splattered the ant's eyes, which bought me a few seconds. I valiantly retreated, raising my sword only to find that the blade had been eaten away, leaving me nothing but a steaming hilt. "Oh, Meg!" I called helplessly. She was otherwise occupied. Her swords whirled in golden arcs of destruction, lopping off leg segments, slicing antennae. I had never seen a Demochiris fight with such skill, and I had seen all the best gladiators in combat. Unfortunately, her blades only sparked off the ant's thick mane carapaces. Glancing blows and dismemberment did not faze them at all. As good as Meg was, the ants had more legs, more weight, more ferocity, and slightly more acid-spitting ability. My own opponent snapped at me. I managed to avoid its mandibles, but its armored face bashed the side of my head. I staggered and fell. One ear canal seemed to fill with molten iron. My vision clouded. Across the clearing, the other ants flanked Meg, using their acid to herd her toward the woods. She dove behind a tree and came up with only one of her blades. She tried to stab the closest ant, but was driven back by acid crossfire. Her leggings were smoking, peppered with holes. Her face was tight with pain. "Peaches," I muttered to myself. "Where is that stupid diaper demon when we need him?" The carpost did not appear. Perhaps the presence of the geyser gods or some other force in the woods kept him away. Perhaps the board of directors had a rule against pets. The third ant loomed over me, its mandibles foaming with green saliva. Its breath smelled worse than Hephaestus's work shirts. My next decision I could blame on my head injury. I could tell you I wasn't thinking clearly, but that isn't true. I was desperate. I was terrified. I wanted to help Meg. Mostly I wanted to save myself. I saw no other option. So I dove for my ukulele. I know. I promised on the River Styx not to play music until I was a god once more. But even such a dire oath can seem unimportant when a giant ant is about to melt your face off. I grabbed the instrument, rolled onto my back, and belted out Sweet Caroline. Even without my oath, I would only have done something like that in the most extreme emergency. When I sing that song, the chances of mutually assured destruction are too great. But I saw no other choice. I gave it my utmost effort, channeling all the saccharine schmaltz I could muster from the 1970s. The giant ant shook its head. Its antennae quivered. I got to my feet as the monster crawled drunkenly toward me. I put my back to the geyser and launched into the chorus. The da-da-da did the trick. Blinded by disgust and rage, the ant charged. I rolled aside as the monster's momentum carried it forward, straight into the muddy cauldron. Believe me, the only thing that smells worse than Hephaestus's work shirts is a Myrmica boiling in its own shell. Somewhere behind me, Meg screamed. I turned in time to see her second sword fly from her hand. She collapsed as one of the Myrmicas caught her in its mandibles. "No!" I shrieked. The ant did not snap her in half. It simply held her, limp and unconscious.
Meg!
I yelled again. I strummed the ukulele desperately.
Sweet Caroline!
But my voice was gone. Defeating one ant had taken all my energy. I don't think I have ever written a sadder sentence than that. I tried to run to Meg's aid, but I stumbled and fell. The world turned pale yellow. I hunched on all fours and vomited. I have a concussion, I thought. But I had no idea what to do about it. It seemed like ages since I had been a god of healing. I may have lay in the mud for minutes or hours while my brain slowly gyrated inside my skull. By the time I managed to stand, the two ants were gone. There was no sign of Meg McCaffrey. Chapter 25. I'm on a roll now. Boiling, burning, throwing up. Lions? Hey, why not? I stumbled through the glade, shouting Meg's name. I knew it was pointless, but yelling felt good. I looked for signs of broken branches or trampled ground. Surely two tank-sized ants would leave a trail I could follow. But I was not Artemis. I did not have my sister's skill with tracking. I had no idea which direction they'd taken my friend. I retrieved Meg's swords from the mud. Instantly they changed into gold rings. So small, so easily lost, like a mortal life. I may have cried. I tried to break my ridiculous combat ukulele, but the celestial bronze instrument defied my attempts. Finally, I yanked off the A-string, threaded it through Meg's rings, and tied them around my neck. Meg, I will find you, I muttered. Her abduction was my fault. I was sure of this. By playing music and saving myself, I had broken my oath on the River Styx. Instead of punishing me directly, Zeus or the Fates, or all the gods together, had visited their wrath upon Meg McCaffrey. How could I have been so foolish? Whenever I angered the other gods, those closest to me were struck down. I'd lost Daphne because of one careless comment to Eros. I'd lost the beautiful Hyacinthus because of a quarrel with Zephyros. Now my broken oath would cost Meg her life. No, I told myself. I won't allow it. I was so nauseous I could barely walk. Someone seemed to be inflating a balloon inside my brain, yet I managed to stumble to the rim of Pete's geyser.
Pete! I shouted. Show yourself, you cowardly telemarketer!
Water shot skyward with a sound like the blast of an organ's lowest pipe. In the swirling steam, the Palakos appeared, his mud-gray face hardening with anger.
You call me a telemarketer? He demanded. We run a full-service PR firm!
I doubled over and vomited in his crater, which I thought an appropriate response.
Stop that! Pete complained.
I need to find Meg. I wiped my mouth with a shaky hand. What would the Myrmecas do with her?
I don't know.
Tell me, or I will not complete your customer service survey. Pete gasped.
That's terrible. Your feedback is important.
He floated down to my side.
Oh, dear. Your head doesn't look good.
You've got a big gash on your scalp, and there's blood. That must be why you're not thinking clearly. I don't care, I yelled,
which only made the pounding in my head worse.
Where is the Myrmica's nest?
Pete wrung his steamy hands.
Well, that's what we were talking about earlier. That's where Polly went. The nest is the only entrance.
To what?
To the Grove of Dodona.
My stomach solidified into a pack of ice, which was unfair because I needed one for my head. The ant nest is the way to the grove?
Look, you need medical attention. I told Polly we should have a first aid station for visitors.
He fished around in his non-existent pockets.
Let me just mark the location of the Apollo cabin.
If you pull out a brochure, I warned, I will make you eat it. Now, explain how the nest leads to the grove. Pete's face turned yellow, or perhaps that was just my vision getting worse.
Polly didn't tell me everything. There's this thicket of woods that's grown so dense nobody can get in. I mean, even from above, the branches are like...
He laced his muddy fingers, then caused them to liquefy and melt into one another, which made his point quite well.
Anyway,
he pulled his hands apart.
The grove is in there. It could have been slumbering for centuries. Nobody on the board of directors even knew about it. Then all of a sudden, the trees started whispering. Polly figured those darned ants must have burrowed into the grove from underneath, and that's what woke it up.
I tried to make sense of that. It was difficult with a swollen brain. Which way is the nest?
North of here, Pete said. Half a mile. But man, you are in no shape.
I must. Meg needs me. Pete grabbed my arm. His grip was like a warm, wet tourniquet.
She's got time. If they carried her off in one piece, that means she's not dead yet.
She will be soon enough.
Nah. Before he disappeared. He went into that nest a few times, looking for the tunnel to the grove. He told me those Myrmecas like to goop up their victims and let them, ripen until they're soft enough for the hatchlings to eat.
I made an ungodlike squeak. If there had been anything left in my stomach, I would have lost it. How long does she have?
24 hours, give or take. Then she'll start to... soften.
It was difficult to imagine Meg McCaffrey softening under any circumstances, but I pictured her alone and scared, encased in insect goop, tucked in some larder of carcasses in the ant's nest. For a girl who hated bugs. Oh, Demeter had been right to hate me and keep her children away from me. I was a terrible god.
Go get some help. Pete urged. The Apollo cabin can heal that head wound. You're not doing your friend any favors by charging after her and getting yourself killed.
Why do you care what happens to us? The geyser god looked offended.
Visitor satisfaction is always our top priority. Besides, if you find Polly while you're in there...
I tried to stay angry at the Palakos. But the loneliness and worry on his face mirrored my own feelings. Did Polly explain how to navigate the ant's nest? Pete shook his head.
Like I said, he didn't want me to follow him. The Myrmecas are dangerous enough. And if those other guys are still wandering around...
Other guys? Pete frowned.
Didn't I mention that? Yeah. Polly saw three humans, heavily armed. They were looking for the grove, too.
My left leg started thumping nervously, as if it missed its three-legged race partner. How did Polly know what they were looking for?
He heard them talking in Latin.
Latin? Were they campers? Pete spread his hands.
I don't think so. Polly described them like they were adults. He said one of them was the leader. The other two addressed him as Imperator.
The entire planet seemed to tilt. Imperator.
Yeah, you know, like in Rome?
Yes, I know. Suddenly, too many things made sense. Pieces of the puzzle flew together, forming one huge picture that smacked me in the face. The Beast. Triumvirate Holdings. Adult demigods completely off the radar. It was all I could do to avoid pitching forward into the geyser. Meg needed me more than ever. But I would have to do this right. I would have to be careful. Even more careful than when I gave the fiery horses of the sun their yearly vaccinations. "Pete," I said, "do you still oversee sacred oaths?"
"Well, yes, but..."
"Then hear my solemn oath.
The thing is, you've got this aura around you like you just broke a sacred oath. Maybe one you swore on the River Styx. And if you break another oath with me..."
"I swear that I will save Meg McCaffrey. I will use every means at my disposal to bring her safely from the Ant's lair. And this oath supersedes any previous oath I have made. This I swear upon your sacred and extremely hot waters." Pete winced.
"Well, okay. It's done now. But keep in mind that if you don't keep that oath, if Meg dies, even if it's not your fault, you'll face the consequences."
"I am already cursed for breaking my earlier oath. What does it matter?"
"Yeah, but see, those River Styx oaths can take years to destroy you. They're like cancer." "My oaths?" Pete shrugged. "If you break it, there's nothing I can do to stop your punishment. Wherever you are, a geyser will instantly blast through the ground at your feet and boil you alive."
"Ah." I tried to stop my knees from knocking. "Yes, of course I knew that. I stand by my oath."
"You've got no choice now."
"Right. I think I'll go get healed." I staggered off.
"Camp is the other direction," Pete said.
I changed course.
"Remember to complete our survey online,"
Pete called after me.
"Just curious, on a scale of 1 to 10, how would you rate your overall satisfaction with the woods at Camp Half-Blood?"
I didn't reply. As I stumbled into the darkness, I was too busy contemplating, on a scale of 1 to 10, the pain I might have to endure in the near future. I didn't have the strength to make it back to camp. The farther I walked, the clearer that became. My joints were pudding. I felt like a marionette, and as much as I'd enjoyed controlling mortals from above in the past, I did not relish being on the other end of the strings. My defenses were at level 0. The smallest hellhound or dragon could have easily made a meal of the great Apollo. If an irritated badger had taken issue with me, I would have been doomed. I leaned against a tree to catch my breath. The tree seemed to push me away, whispering in a voice I remembered so well. "Keep moving, Apollo. You can't rest here." "I loved you," I muttered. Part of me knew I was delirious, imagining things only because of my concussion. But I swore I could see the face of my beloved Daphne rising from each tree trunk I passed. Her features floating under the bark like a mirage of wood. Her slightly crooked nose. Her offset green eyes. Those lips I had never kissed, but never stopped dreaming of. "You loved every pretty girl," she scolded. "And every pretty boy, for that matter." "Not like you," I cried. "You were my first true love. Oh, Daphne, wear my crown," she said, "and repent." I remembered chasing her, her lilac scent on the breeze, her lithe form flitting through the dappled light of the forest. I pursued her for what seemed like years. Perhaps it was. For centuries afterward, I blamed Eros. In a moment of recklessness, I had ridiculed Eros's archery skills. Out of spite, he struck me with a golden arrow. He bent all my love toward the beautiful Daphne, but that was not the worst of it. He also struck Daphne's heart with a lead arrow, leeching all possible affection she might have had for me. What people do not understand, Eros's arrows can't summon emotion from nothing. They can only cultivate potential that is already there. Daphne and I could have been a perfect pair. She was my true love. She could have loved me back. Yet thanks to Eros, my love-o-meter was cranked to 100%, while Daphne's feelings turned to pure hate. Which is, of course, only the flip side of love. Nothing is more tragic than loving someone to the depths of your soul and knowing they cannot and will not ever love you back. The stories say I chased her on a whim, that she was just another pretty dress. The stories are wrong. When she begged Gia to turn her into a laurel tree in order to escape me, part of my heart hardened into bark as well. I invented the laurel wreath to commemorate my failure, to punish myself for the fate of my greatest love. Every time some hero wins the laurels, I am reminded of the girl I can never win. After Daphne, I swore I would never marry. Sometimes I claimed that was because I couldn't decide between the 9 muses. A convenient story. The 9 muses were my constant companions, all of them beautiful in their own way. But they never possessed my heart like Daphne did. Only one other person ever affected me so deeply. The perfect Hyacinthus. And he, too, was taken from me. All of these thoughts rambled through my bruised brain. I staggered from tree to tree, leaning against them, grabbing their lowest branches like handrails. "You cannot die here," Daphne whispered. "You have work to do. You made an oath." Yes, my oath. Meg needed me. I had to. I fell face forward in the icy mulch. How long I lay there, I'm not sure. A warm snout breathed in my ear. A rough tongue lapped my face. I thought I was dead and Cerberus had found me at the gates of the underworld. Then the beast pushed me over onto my back. Dark tree branches laced the sky. I was still in the forest. The golden visage of a lion appeared above me, his amber eyes beautiful and deadly. He licked my face, perhaps trying to decide if I would make a good supper. I spit mane fur out of my mouth. "Wake up," said a woman's voice, somewhere to my right. It wasn't Daphne, but it was vaguely familiar. I managed to raise my head. Nearby, a second lion sat at the feet of a woman with tinted glasses and a silver and gold tiara in her braided hair. Her batik dress swirled with images of fern fronds. Her arms and hands were covered in henna tattoos. She looked different than she had in my dream, but I recognized her. "Rhea," I croaked. She inclined her head. "Peace, Apollo. I don't want to bum you out, but we need to talk." Chapter 26. Imperators here. Gag me with a peace symbol. Not groovy, Mama. My head wound must have tasted like Wagyu beef. The lion kept licking the side of my face, making my hair stickier and wetter. Strangely, this seemed to clear my thoughts. Perhaps lion saliva had curative properties. I guess I should have known that, being a god of healing. But you'll have to excuse me if I haven't done trial-and-error experiments with the drool of every single animal. With difficulty, I sat up and faced the Titan Queen. Rhea leaned against the side of a VW safari van, painted with swirling black frond designs like those on her dress. I seemed to recall that the black fern was one of Rhea's symbols, but I couldn't remember why. Among the gods, Rhea had always been something of a mystery. Even Zeus, who knew her best, did not often speak of her. Her turret crown circled her brow like a glittering railroad track. When she looked down at me, her tinted glasses changed from orange to purple.